I hate to tell you this, but it turns out that traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat. I know, very disgusting. Not only is it extremely gross, but it also leads to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning, antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacteria growth and require up to 3 times less laundry. If you get hot at night, you'll appreciate Miracle Made's self-cooling properties, which makes use of silver-infused fabrics inspired by NASA. If it's good enough for the astronauts, it's good enough for me. They are thermoregulating and designed to keep you at the perfect temperature all night long. It makes a huge difference in getting better sleep every night. If you hate sleeping in bacteria, which I'm sure you do, or you're looking to get rid of your worn and uncomfortable bedding, you should check out Miracle Made. You'll feel like you're tucked into a luxurious hotel fancy bedding situation, but it'll be a lower cost than some of those other brands. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save over 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code THESTACKS at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you aren't 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiraclemade.com/thestacks and use the code THESTACKS to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and today I am pleased to welcome two professors of sociology, Pamela Prickett and Stefan Timmermans, to the podcast. Pamela and Stefan have written a book called The Unclaimed, Abandonment and Hope in the City of Angels. It's a narrative nonfiction story that focuses on 4 individuals that go unclaimed and what their experiences say about the broader system that leaves thousands unclaimed in America. We talk about the immense amount of research that went into the book, why they wanted to write about the dead, and how they worked together as a team to tell this story. As a reminder, the Stacks Book Club pick for March is Interior Chinatown by Charles Yu. We will discuss that book on March 27th with Elise Hugh. Quick reminder, everything we talk about on each episode of The Stacks can be found in the link in the show notes. And in case you missed it, I have a new Substack. You can find me at tracythomas.substack.com. It's called Unstacked. I'm writing about books and pop culture, and it's amazing. If you like what you hear today, consider joining The Stacks Pack, which is our community for book lovers. You can find it on patreon.com/thestacks. By joining, you make it possible for me to make this independent book podcast every single week, and you get a slew of perks for yourself, like our monthly virtual book club, access to our Discord community, bonus episodes, shout outs on the show, and guess what? It is only $5 a month. So head to patreon.com/thestacks and join. Shout out to our newest members of The Stacks Pack: Caitlin Peterson, Kelly Brown, Talia Adderley, Kia W., Hannah, Savoris Taylor, Rachel Placetti, and Emily Joel. Thank you all so much for joining the Stacks Pack, and thank you to the entire Stacks Pack. Y'all are the best. All right, now it is time for my conversation with Pamela Prickett and Stefan Timmermans. All right, everybody. I am so excited today. I am joined by 2 authors who wrote a book called The Unclaimed, Abandonment and Hope in the City of Angels. The authors are Pamela Prickett and Stefan Timmermans. Thank you guys so much for being here. Welcome to The Stacks.
Thank you so much for having us. And thank you for showing up at our book launch. We are deeply appreciative.
That was so fun. I was so excited I was able to come. I have to tell you all, this book and this cover, which I want to talk about eventually, is exactly in my wheelhouse of shit that I'm into. It's Los Angeles. It is dark, dark death, scary stuff. The cover is a photograph of a place with a tint on it. This is like all of my favorite things. So Roxana Asgharian, who wrote We Were Once a Family, which was like my favorite book of last year, she blurbed this and she posted when she was reading it on her Instagram, like, oh, I'm reading this book. And I immediately went in her DMs and was like, do I have to read this? And she said, it's very you, which is a yes. I'm so glad she did. I had such a great time with this book. And that's enough of me raving about it. I want you to tell folks in about 30 seconds or so just what the book is about.
Well, the book is about people who die in Los Angeles without any next of kin willing or able to claim them. And then what happens when the county of Los Angeles kind of steps in to play the role of surrogate, next of kin, and organized disposition. And it follows four characters, or I should say four individuals, who are at risk of going unclaimed and kind of looking at what happened in their lives to get to the point that they would be at risk of going unclaimed.
And Seven, how did you all decide to work together on this project?
So I knew Pamela at UCLA, where she did a PhD, and you know, as PhD students, we launched them into the world, and she was launched very far. She went to Amsterdam, University of Amsterdam, but then she came back and asked to collaborate on this book, and it's at the intersection of both our interests. I'm a sociologist who's very fascinated by bad deaths. So we have a script in society about what good dying is all about. Mm-hmm. Painless, at the bedside, mm-hmm. Following the wishes of the individual. I'm interested in all the deaths that fall outside that spectrum and how we make sense of that. So I'm interested in violent deaths, unexpected deaths, deaths that people struggle with. And this is another one of those instances where, you know, you die and the expectation is that somebody will organize your funeral. And for centuries, it has been the family who has had this responsibility. But what happens when the family abandons the body? And Pamela had a different way into this project.
Okay, Pamela, what was your way in?
So I will tell your listeners that this is not a topic that I had any experience with or any knowledge of. Kind of just gone through life and taking this sort of idea for granted. And then several years ago, I was doing that PhD research for my PhD at UCLA, and I was studying a mosque in South Central Los Angeles, where I had been kind of in the community, observing the community for many years. And one of the longtime members, they call women sisters and men brothers. So one of the sisters, Sister Sherry, had passed away. And she was estranged from her family of origin. And she had really been relying on the mosque for decades as her main source of social support. And when she passed, there was during Ramadan that the one night in the back of the prayer hall, I was sitting there and the head imam got up and he said, you know, Sister Sherry has passed and she's on the verge of going unclaimed, which would mean she'd be cremated in the county of Los Angeles, which is against the religious community's belief. So he rallied the members, they organized a fundraiser to go to court to get the right to claim her body and then to provide a proper Muslim burial for her. And so it was after that that I said, okay, what happens if you die in Los Angeles with no family? And in this case, you know, I would say no religious community, what takes place? And that's what started me down this journey.
Wow. Okay. So in the book, we follow four individuals who you all, as researchers, sociologists, journalists, which you sort of wear all of those hats throughout the book, which is another thing that I love, you all meet these people after they're dead, which is really interesting because that's not normally how these investigative journalism books work. Maybe if you're investigating a murder, maybe. But in this case, everyone who's central to the book, or like the four central characters, are all people you've come to after they've died. And because they're unclaimed, you know, the assumption is sort of that they have maybe a smaller social circle or that they have a smaller network of people for you all to interview. And that was pretty much the case for two of them. And then two of them kind of had broader circles. But I'm wondering, when you get to writing this book and you pick your four people, where do you go? What do you do? What questions are you asking? And who are you asking these questions to?
Yes, that is a great question. So, you know, I should back up for just a second and say that we looked at more than 600 cases in depth. And so we selected these four cases from those 600. And we were really sort of looking for characters or individuals that would reflect larger patterns that we saw across the data, right? So, And that's the sociology hat that we're wearing, right? And once we decide on those four individuals, we then step into more journalist mode. And it was really kind of not your traditional social science ethnography in that you have one place that you go or a couple places that you go and you sit and observe people, right? Because they had passed away, as you said. And so it really resulted in having to become both investigative reporters who were willing to go knock on doors, literally knock on the doors of places where people had been living before they passed, on the doors of their neighbors, calling family who, you know, had the county had located or who I had located or Stephen located, and then, you know, trying to kind of understand the decedents. And it also involved a lot of genealogy research. So that was one thing that I didn't expect to be wearing, but we had some great kind of training, if you will, from professional genealogists like Megan Smolenyak, who started an organization called unfoundpersons.org. And they kind of taught us what we needed to do and started using all the databases that we, you know, discovered the coroner's office also uses to track down family. And so, yeah, it was this like, you know, kind of shifting the hats, and then just anybody we could talk to, we would.
Well, and it turns out that what makes the unclaimed really fascinating, the fact that they have been invisible in life and now are forgotten in death, makes them also really difficult to study them or to find them, because we're dealing with people where the family said, we don't want anything to do with them. We do not want to have their burial. So to go in there and find people willing to talk to us, we were really worried that this might not take off, this might fail. But in fact, we did find a lot of families very happy to give their side of the story. So it was a challenge. And also we chose these four characters pretty much strategically, in the sense that they reflected some of the broader patterns. But we didn't know as much about them when we started. But it turns out that all four of them have fascinating lives. Mm-hmm. And all four of them were really interesting in their own way, and their stories would have gotten forgotten if we hadn't been there. And so that makes us think. I mean, every year Los Angeles County buries between 1,500 and 2,000 unclaimed people in Boyle Heights, and so it makes us think: what are all the other stories that are just forgotten and buried there in a mass grave with the ashes commingled?
Right. I mean, I think that's what's so interesting about the book is like everyone does have a really interesting story. And it is sort of like, not to be too like corny, but it's sort of like we all are interesting people. Like we're all worthy of having our stories told, which again, you know, I really resist the urge to like do the Disney special on this one. But it did kind of have that vibe of it about the book, like as we're getting to know these people. And you mentioned you guys sifted through like 600. You had 600 options that you could have chosen from, and you narrowed it down to these four. How far into the process did you decide it was these four people? Like, how much did you know about them when you were like, okay, we're going with Midge, like we're going with David?
Yeah, so a lot of that comes from at the point that we decided to work with Crown Publishing and our amazing editor, Amanda Cook. And so we tell this in the acknowledgments. So I just want to kind of tell your listeners this funny story. So we kind of are shopping around this book during COVID, actually, in 2020. And we had, was it, Stefan, maybe 8 or 9 publishers? I can't remember exactly who were interested.
Eight
who were interested in the book. And all of them said, this is great, go forward. And at that point, the proposal was kind of more of a big idea book. It wasn't as kind of drawn into these. We didn't have these four folks decided on. And Amanda came into the meeting and she was the only person who said, you know, this is a good start. And so everyone else said, you know, we could publish this right away as is. And she said, no, this is a good start. So we worked with Amanda to sort of think about, you know, what are the cases that could draw out larger points that we did see. And as Stefan said, at that point, some of them we didn't know. I mean, we weren't yet into the journey of really figuring out. For example, David was just a challenge to learn about, because he's one of these, you know, more solo types who are living off the grid. But as we got into the process of learning, it just felt like, yeah, we picked the four best people that we could have to write about. And I just want to say, like, when I tell people, and for the last couple of years, when I've been telling people what I've been writing about, they'll always say, oh, Unclaimed Us. So you're writing about the homeless. Well, there are a lot of people who are homeless that are among the unclaimed, but there are many people who are unclaimed that weren't unhoused or living on the streets or dying on the streets, right? And so it was really important to us to also be able to show the kind of wide array of stories of people who are going unclaimed and kind of show you that it's not who you expect. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And that's the sense in which Mitch is, for instance, extraordinarily interesting, because from the outside, if you would have passed her in her last years of life, you would see a tiny woman living in a van with cats. That's probably what you would have noticed. But once we start peeling back the layers of her life, she was really ingrained in this wider church family who rallied for her. She was a contributor to their community life. She was involved in summer camps with the church. She did outreach with some of the church people. And so none of that would be visible. But so she, at first sight, she's a homeless person living in a van. But if you start digging a little deeper, she's deeply embedded in a social community.
Yeah. And I think, like, what I found really interesting and maybe upsetting about the book is that a lot of these people did have people in their lives who would have claimed their bodies and would have given them a quote unquote proper burial. I think Midge is like the most obvious example, because she had this church community who, towards the end of her life, not only did they, you know, not only did the church allow her to live in her van on their property, but eventually they rallied money to have one set of parishioners remodel their garage to make it their to make it an apartment for her to live in. Like, they took her to her dialysis. They were caring for her in the ways that family cares for people. But when it came time, when she died and it came time for arrangements to be made, they offered to do it, and the county found kin. They found next of kin. They found family. At which point, those people become the people who are responsible. But those people hadn't been around her. She had left town. She had moved away because she had maybe some traumatic experiences, and she had created her own life and her own people. And because she didn't have a will, that was who the responsibility was left to, the family members. And so she ends up being an unclaimed person. And I just found that to be so upsetting, because it feels like the county just got in the way of Midge. Like, she had figured it out. She had made herself a life that she was happy to be living in, and found people who were happy to be living in her life with her. And then after she died, it was like, nope, that doesn't matter to us. We want this, the county wants you to be buried by family. So I guess the question is the only way to avoid for sure being unclaimed, for the most part, like having it in your will who you want to bury you?
So first of all, I want to reiterate what you just said, is that indeed the county can stand in the way. The county doesn't necessarily pay attention to the quality of the relationship between the decedent and the people in their lives, in their social circle. But the county looks for a next of kin legally defined. And so unless you appoint somebody, it is the, there's like a scheme where it goes from, different relatives, and whoever comes up first in the boxes, that's the next of kin. And that person is then saddled with the task of burying the decedent. And so what we see is that some people are, you know, given this task who are completely inappropriate. People have been estranged. And then other people could have been happy and willing to do, to organize a funeral, but they're not asked. So the quality of the relationship is being ignored. And indeed, like, if you think about it from an individual level, one of the ways that you can avoid going unclaimed is appointing somebody, putting your affairs in order, talking to your relatives. And this can be a gift because then they don't have to figure out who's going to do it and what. So if you have these conversations in advance, it can make a real difference. The reality, unfortunately, is that very few people have these kind of conversations in advance. And it's also sort of putting the responsibility for the burial on the individual. And so the deeper underlying causes of people going unclaimed is more estrangement and social isolation. And so what the phenomenon of unclaimed and the rising figures sort of prompts us to think about is, do we want to be in a society where people end up going unclaimed? Or is there something more systemic that we can do? Can we address social isolation? Can we start to talk about how widespread estrangement is? And so if we maybe change the conditions that lead people to going unclaimed, we don't necessarily have to shoulder the individual with this responsibility, but we live in a society where that becomes just very rare.
Yeah. This is a really me kind of question. Okay. I don't know if anyone else has asked you guys this yet. I doubt it. It's sort of weird. But one of the things I was thinking about when reading the book, I understand that like socially we are told and like historically we are told that like to bury someone and to like have a funeral is really important and it's a nice thing to do to claim someone and bury them. But is there really anything wrong with being unclaimed? Is there really anything wrong with being buried amongst other people of your city? You know, obviously, if you have religious beliefs around being cremated or not, maybe there is. But like, I feel like the burial industry has become such an industry. Mm. And when I was thinking about it, I was sort of like, you know, what if we just were okay with saying, if you died this year, you are amongst the people who lived and died this year. And we all just like end up in these, you know, places together. Is that the end of the world? Am I like missing something? Am I terrible?
You know, we have gotten this question a couple of times, and I love that you ask it because I think it's worthy of a conversation. You know, I think Stefan and I have our view definitely after this book, which I'm going to talk about. But I just want to preface by saying, you know, it's a question that's worthy of much wider discussion. And we do hope to generate more conversation among the public, you know, among folks about these sorts of questions. I mean, the first thing I would say to you is that if that's the choice we make as a society, that is a historic shift. I mean, for as long as human beings have existed, even our ancestors in the Paleolithic and Neolithic period, you know, went to great efforts to bury their dead, right? To ritualize the burial. If you look at ancient Greek tragedies, if you look at German philosophers and across history and time, you will see tremendous focus in thinking about what the role of burial does to distinguish us from other species. And so it is, it's, you know, it's really kind of if that's where we're going as a society, that is a really historic shift. And I think it's one that we should pause and have a conversation about so we don't just move forward and think, oh, this is just, you know, how can it happen. The other thing I would say is that I don't think anyone grows up saying, I really would like to go unclaimed. When I die, I hope there's nobody there for me. I think it really goes against what we sort of imagine when we're growing up, when we think about a life well lived, right? So there's this expression, proverb, it's attributed to many different cultures and times and places, but it's essentially says, they say we die twice, once when the breath leaves our body, and the second time when the last person we know says our name, or the last person says our name. And so I think it's this idea that, you know, you live on through the memories of others, right? The impact that you've had and the unclaimed sort of put into question, you know, what does it all mean if there isn't somebody there saying your name? And in some cases in the book, you know, quite honestly, there were people whose names were not being spoken long before they had, you know, stopped breathing. And you know, so, and the last thing I want to say is just like when folks read the book, I think what they'll encounter is a really beautiful ceremony in Los Angeles for the unclaimed. But by and large, what happens in the United States and what happens around the world is a really different outcome. And so while you can look at the burial in Boyle Heights and say this beautiful interfaith ceremony is gorgeous and why not be buried alongside many other Angelenos, you know, in many places throughout the United States, you know, people are cremated, their ashes are left in a drawer somewhere, or they're buried without any sort of recognition or moment of honoring them. So it's, you know, that's where Los Angeles kind of becomes the sort of best case scenario in this situation.
Yeah, I think I was maybe persuaded by the ceremony a little bit, that I was like, this isn't the worst thing I've ever heard of. I think when I picked up the book, I was like, this is the worst thing possible. But I also think that maybe, like, you know, I don't know. I think that maybe, like, the worst thing possible, maybe my imagination is not great.
Well, so another thing that happens to unclaimed bodies that we actually have never talked about is that they're sort of the default for dissection in medical schools and in mortuary schools. So even in Los Angeles at this time, the mortuary school, Cypress College, gets its bodies from unclaimed cases. So that further underscores the marginalization of unclaimed. Mm-hmm. That's not really something people aspire to, because before unclaimed bodies, the default for bodies to be used in medical schools were the bodies of people condemned to death.
Yeah.
You know, after they're being executed.
Yeah. I want to ask you guys a little bit about sort of the ethics of this book, because I know that that's something you talk about. I mean, the beginning of the book starts where you say that you're going to use people's real names, which, you know, in these kinds of books, sometimes people do, sometimes people don't. But I think also because the main focus of your book, the four individuals, are dead before you ever meet them. You know, they can't consent to this. Like, how much of their lives are you going to share with the world? How did you all sort of negotiate that with, like, wanting to tell the story, wanting to use their names because you wanted to remember them and because you wanted to make sure that their stories lived on, but also feeling this obligation of, like, being the keeper of these people's lives, that you've, you know, sort of dug into their histories in a way that many people in their own lives didn't even know. So I'm just wondering what those conversations for the two of you were sort of like.
Yeah, so that's a really fair question. And as you say, one that we address at different points in the book, at the beginning and later towards the end. You know, we thought about this a lot. We thought about this in terms of when we were selecting those four individuals from the many cases, sort of thinking about, you know, how much does one reveal? In many cases, you know, we came to learn more about the decedents and their lives than even the people who had known them. And so you're holding some really powerful knowledge, right? And we had to be incredibly careful and judicious in terms of how we thought about that and how we negotiated it. And as you said, sort of having these conversations with each other and our editors. One thing that sort of assuaged my concerns about this was as we started talking to friends and family, and they were often both willing to talk to us much more than you maybe think, right? In terms of the topic, you know, they wanted their perspectives known and shown. And then I think the people who cared so much for Bobby, Lena, Midge, and David really wanted those stories told, didn't want to be thought that their friends, their loved ones, you know, their stories were just sort of fading into the dirt, right? With the grave in Boyle Heights, and to draw attention. And so while there's some, you know, fair discussions to be had and questions, and, you know, we appreciate being, when folks kind of ask these questions and push back, but there's also a recognition in the value and the obligation to tell stories that might not otherwise be known. For people, just the fact that they go unclaimed brings up a lot of stigma and stereotypes that, frankly, we're trying to show are just not accurate. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's also sort of the ethical momentum of this book, is that because these people are forgotten, we have a responsibility, you know, to tell their stories. And I mean, we want to bring this phenomenon of unclaimed to the world. And so you need to dig into these particular kind of stories. But there, we have been judicious in the way that we have told these stories. We know, as Pamela said, we know more about these people than many others. And a lot of it stayed on the cutting room floor.
Right. I just want to read from the end of your book, where you all talk a little bit about your research process because I was really just blown away. So I'm just going to read, this is in the About This Project section, because I just want folks to understand how much research and work you did, because I was really like, whoa. So this is what you say in this paragraph. This is one paragraph. It says, when all was said and done, we conducted 23 interviews, directly observed 15 death investigations, reviewed in detail more than 600 additional deaths between the medical examiner's files and court records of public administrator cases, examined lengthy conservatorship cases for another 26 people, logged more than 20 visits to the county crematorium, attended 37 funerals and ceremonies for unclaimed dead, recorded more than 200 hours of video and audio, including nearly 40 hours of ceremonies, consulted more than 8,500 pages of official records, and quantitatively analyzed more than 16,000 unclaimed deaths. That's a wow. That's a lot. I mean, the question is, how long did it take? How did you do it? Talk about it.
Yeah. So that's why it took 8 years, right? And it goes back to, it goes back to sort of what we talked about a little bit earlier, in the sense of like, this is not an easy, you know, kind of group of individuals to study and to try to draw out information on. And so it took a lot of time. It also was an ethical choice to be careful and to take the slow path, to build rapport, to really show and demonstrate to individuals who we were talking to about their loved ones that we had, you know, we were taking these stories with as serious and with reverence. And then I just want to point out that, you know, part of it was just, there's a tremendous amount of bureaucracy here that we had to navigate as well. And so that was, you know, we kind of had to fight the bureaucracy to get the information and often work around the bureaucracy to get information.
Right. How did you know when you were done? How did you know at the end of 7 or 8 years that this was it? Like, there was no more to be done.
We had a contract.
It's never done. No, it's actually, we had contact with a relative of one of the people we discuss in the book after the manuscript was finished. So it just, things keep popping up and there's more to talk about. But at some point, you just have to put some boundaries on this situation. And, you know, there's the, We talk in social sciences about data saturation, and at some point you feel like you got a story and more variations might emerge, but they're not really moving the goalposts. Mm. They're sort of giving you an overall sense of what you already know, and they add more color maybe, or a slight twitch somewhere else. But at some point you really know how these bureaucracies work, what happens in people's lives, and you have a good idea. I was at a dinner party and I was talking about this unclaimed to somebody who didn't know anything about this book. And she said, actually, I knew somebody who went unclaimed. I worked in a women's homeless shelter. And she said, I know what really was behind it. And she said, it was estrangement. Mm. And we said, yeah, that's exactly what we've been writing about for all. So she hadn't read the book, but she came up with estrangement. And once you get those kind of signals, you know you got the story. Yeah. And then you can just, you know, write it up.
Was there anything that is not in the book that you wished could have been?
Well, one of the things that I really wish we could have done, but of course it's logistically almost impossible, is we could have followed people before, knowing them before they went unclaimed, and then actually get their side of the story. So one of the limitations of coming in after people die and they're estranged is that we get the perspective of their family, or we get the perspective of their neighbor, but we don't have their own voices and their own interpretations. So that to me is a limitation, but it's almost impossible to follow. And it's kind of morbid to follow people around and say, oh, you're going to go unclaimed. Let's see what happens. So we got very attached to Bobby, to Mitch, to David, and to Lena, but we never met them. I mean, we feel we know them, but we don't have their voices and having their side of the story. We have their families, their neighbors, their friends' perspective on them.
Pamela, do you want to share what you wished?
Yeah. So one of the things we haven't talked much about yet is the kind of volunteers, the groups of people who are coming together to mourn the unclaimed, right? So we talked about Boyle Heights, right? So people showing up at the ceremony every year. There's also two organizations we write about in the book, one that's working to bury unclaimed veterans and another that's working to bury abandoned babies. Now there is a third kind of group of volunteer mourners that didn't work to get into the book because it was outside. We discovered later, we sort of intentionally decided that it didn't work because the circumstances were really different. But that's the number of tremendous number of organizations and volunteers who are working on behalf of missing migrants, people who are dying at the border while trying to come in from Mexico through Central America. And, you know, just the tremendous efforts to sort of get those bodies identified and to notify their families. And we didn't include it because we came to see it as not the same sort of story. They weren't unclaimed. They were unclaimable.
Right.
As a result of immigration policies and choices as to how we allocate resources. So that's something where I felt we decided it didn't work. It didn't fit in the book, but it's something that I wish people knew about, right? Really understood that there's a crisis in this sense at the border. That's what I would say is the real crisis at the border, is the way that we are allowing people to go intentionally be unclaimed by virtue of not identifying them.
Right. Okay, we have to take a quick break and then we'll be back. It's important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality, and that's why for almost 4 years now, I have been drinking AG1. Unlike many supplement brands, AG1 is constantly searching for how to do things better. They're at 52 iterations of their formula and counting. Their team is always trying to find better ways to source, test, and find the best quality ingredients available. So many people have asked me if AG1 is actually the real deal. And trust me, there's a reason why I've been drinking it for so long. Quality for AG1 isn't just a buzzword. It's a commitment backed by expert-led scientific research, high-quality ingredients, industry-leading manufacturing, and rigorous testing. At each step of the process, AG1 goes above and beyond industry standards. I know I can trust what's in every scoop of AG1 because they totally obsess over product quality, the standards of manufacturing partners, and sustainable practices. Taking care of my health shouldn't be complicated, and AG1 simplifies this by covering my nutritional bases and setting myself up for success in just 60 seconds each morning. AG1 ingredients are heavily researched for efficacy and quality, and I love that every scoop also includes vitamin C and zinc to support my immune system, which is so important for me, especially with the germs that the mini stacks have running around and going to a cesspool called preschool. I've stayed partnered with AG1 for so long because they make such a high quality product, and I genuinely look forward to drinking it every single day. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1 year supply of vitamin D3 and K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/thestacks. That's drinkag1.com/thestacks. Check it out.
Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Okay, we're back. I want to talk about the cover. Were you all involved in this process at all? I love it. It's already top contender for favorite cover of 2024. It's very much my shit. But I'm just curious if you all had any input on it or if that was the Crown team kind of just working their magic.
Pamela had strong opinions.
We were asked to sort of present some ideas. But then I have to tell you, the designers came up with three possibilities. Mm-hmm. This was one of them. Everybody on the team agreed, this has to be it. I mean, it just, like you said, there's this haze over the mm-hmm. skyline, and the book opens in a time in which Los Angeles was experiencing wildfires, and the air was just, you know, it had its own haze. And so to me, it just felt like the designer, Anna, did just such an amazing job of capturing what this book is. And so, yeah, it was. And I have to say, like, at first I was like, ooh, yellow, that's bright. But then I thought, like, I thought, oh, for people who organize their books by color,
hello,
this is a great addition.
I love it here. This is very much me. I just love this. This is, again, my favorite kind of cover, a photograph for like a nonfiction book cover. I love it. It's bright. It's great. I mean, the tag, the whole thing, it's an A+ cover for me. Okay, here's what I want to know. How do you write? How many hours a day? How often? Music or no? Snacks and beverages? Rituals? I know that, Pamela, you were in Amsterdam. Stefan, you were here in Los Angeles. So just, you know, set the scene for me how each of you like to write.
Okay, I'm going to start this one, Stefan, because the first thing I have to have is coffee.
How do you take it?
Black filter, pour over, ideal.
Okay.
And I have to tell you this story. I'm going to tell this story to your listeners that nobody knows. So Stefan here had never been a coffee drinker.
Okay.
And even in the first several years when we're doing a lot of the research for this book, he was just looking at me like, I better get you a coffee, but I just don't get you and this obsession you have with coffee. And then a few years ago, I gave him a challenge. Because we had to do some fun things on the side. We had to give each other some fun challenges, right? Because this is a heavy book.
Yeah.
So I had challenged him, you know, I want you to go out and just try every kind of coffee on the menu at some like, you know, hipster coffee place. Start with a mocha because it's like basically a hot chocolate and work your way to the pour over. And he was game for the challenge. And then once he got to the pour over, he was a convert.
Wow.
And now he has taken it to a whole new level. And so all of that is a long-winded way of saying, like, we start with coffee.
Okay.
Regardless of what continent we're in. Right, Stefan?
Yes. So mocha was the gateway drug.
Yeah. And then it was sort of from the years of doing, you know, the research, you know, as social scientists call it, the field work, which is this very sort of strange term to continue to be using in this day and age. But I would be coming to Los Angeles quite often from Amsterdam. So I do apologize to Mother Nature for my carbon footprint. It's a bad one. And we would sort of, when we were together, always say, oh my gosh, it's so different when we're writing together versus apart. But how can we had to have a lot of honest conversations. Like, where are our strengths? How do we make this 9-hour time difference work? And so it was really nice to have a collaboration where, you know, I could work during the day. And then at the end of my work day, I sort of close the file and hand it off to Stefan, who's just beginning the start of his work day. And then he would push it through. And so when we're writing, it was nice to be able to send it back and forth. And because there was so much that had to be done in person, I kept coming back to Los Angeles. And so once we got a little bit further along in the writing process, it was nice to be able to sort of go over and have conversations. And this is a nice little tidbit for anybody who's interested in writing narrative nonfiction. We took on post-it notes and wrote every scene, every point we wanted to make.
Wow.
And then we would map it out on the wall and sort of move post-it notes around. And that was the kind of thing where we made the most of when I was in Los Angeles, and we had these, you know, to do this together and have conversations and really think about, okay, how do you want to end a chapter? How do you want to start a chapter? So yeah, it was a lot of conversation, a lot of honest conversation about what our strengths are in writing, and playing to those strengths. That's one of the things Stefan always says. You got to play to your strengths.
Right, right. That's very smart. Very, very professor-like to say something like that.
Exactly.
I feel like I'm back in college.
And we have different strengths. So I'm pretty good at throwing a whole bunch of words on the page. And then Pamela is very good at rewriting it and sort of building the sequences and the timing and the beats, often by cutting, 70-80% of what I've written. But then the remaining 20% is really good rough draft. And I have to write in the morning. So I need to get up first and almost immediately sit behind the computer with the coffee now, since I've now I've developed an addiction. And then I need to have music in the background.
What kind of music?
Anything that is not distracting me. So it's sort of like really background noise that puts me in a particular kind of writing mode. And then it's an issue of, to me, the writing process is like writing until you bump into a barrier. Mm-hmm. And then it's like going for walks and biking and just thinking, sitting with it, being really frustrated. And then seeing a way out, then writing that out. And then, of course, you bump into a new barrier. So it's all this process of moving and stopping and then moving again. And it's really nice to have a co-author to run this by and then just talk it out. But the passing the draft back and forth was really great, because when you were sleeping, the other person was working on it. And it's as if in your sleep, you moved the manuscript ahead.
I love that. It's like, oh, I'm amazing. Look what I did in my sleep. This is a question. This is the answer to how do you get more hours in your day? You just have a partner working on it 9 hours ahead or behind you. And then when you sleep, magic happens.
Exactly.
Okay, Stefan, I have to ask you, in the book, there's a mention, I think this is towards the end, like in the afterword or whatever, or maybe about this book, where the phrase social hierarchy of mourning comes up.
Okay.
And that's your work, right? That's the work that you were doing. You talked about bad deaths, but can you just tell us what social hierarchy of mourning means and why that's something that you are interested in?
So I'm fascinated by the fact that some deaths bring the entire world together. Like the death of Princess Diana, it's like a marker in collective world history. And people who never met British royalty, lived through the funeral and through that event and might still be deeply touched and have strong opinions about that. And then you sort of you go down in terms of how much of a mark we leave on the world. And then you have these people at the bottom, the people that we're talking about who were almost forgotten before they even died. Mm-hmm. And so I'm interested in how do you have this stratification of social value that is apparent through mourning practices. Like because it's not really something that somebody gets paid to be remembered. It's a way that these deaths resonate. And you have deaths that bring communities together, but you also have deaths that sort of like evaporate even before the body is cold. And so I'm, as a social scientist, there's something really interesting about how there's an element of social status being enacted in an implicit way in who we mourn and how much we remember them and how much we're willing to participate in remembering them.
Does that also work for like larger scale deaths? Like, I'm just thinking about like how in certain wars, we become very obsessed with like the people who are killed, whereas other wars, like we don't. I mean, like, is that also part of it?
Exactly. And even there in certain of the wars, the violation of the bodies, it's like adding post-mortem injury to the dead through the living, because then they're not allowed to mourn. They're not allowed to retrieve the body. Man, that comes back to your question of, who cares about going unclean? People care very deeply that they can bury their dead in a war situation. And so one of the war tactics is actually trying to obstruct this kind of mourning. Yes, so it definitely goes. And there's these iconic images of deaths that sort of start to resonate. But then we know that there's like probably hundreds, if not thousands more deaths that nobody notices. And again, there's some kind of sorting out of which deaths count and for whom do they count and how do they galvanize public opinion in favor or against the war.
Gosh, okay. And you've written a book about this?
Not yet.
Okay, well, can you let me know when you do? I want to read it. I'm like, I need the sequel of The Unclaimed called The Social Hierarchy of Mourning. I'm like so fascinated. Okay, you're both very smart people. You're professors. You are fancy, fancy people. What is the word that each of you cannot spell correctly on the first try?
Half of them in the book.
I wasn't going to say that, but that's actually true.
Pamela's a bad speller. Welcome to the club, Pamela. I'm a terrible speller. Terrible.
Genealogy. I can never get genealogy right.
There's
need
an A in there, right?
Somewhere.
Floating.
Yeah.
So here is how it works. Pamela is not the best speller, but she has an amazing memory. So I can sort of, you know, forget some of the details, but my spelling is usually fine. So again, that's how we are complimented. Would you say so, Pamela?
I think that's absolutely fair.
So you can spell every word, Stefan, that's what you're telling me?
I can spell most words, or of course, I mean, you know, the word processing program helps you to get it right.
Sure. Well, that's called cheating. And even that, I'm such a bad speller that sometimes the word processing app is like, we don't know. We know that's wrong, but we don't know what you're trying to do. Like you're so far gone today. Yeah. So for people who love The Unclaimed, what are some books you might recommend to them that are in conversation with what you all have done? I know last night at the event, Pamela, you mentioned that there were no even articles about this until 2016. Mm. So I know that perhaps there's not going to be stuff that's exactly the same conversation, but sort of, you know, in the same world, maybe same style, whatever. Whatever the conversation means to you too.
Yeah, no, I love that question. So one book that immediately comes to mind is by a British writer who is also works for a local council in England who handles public health funerals. So in the UK, because they have the national health system, they actually have a means to provide public health funerals. So for funerals for people who would be unclaimed otherwise. And the book is From Ashes to Admin by Evie King, E-V-I-E King. And I think that's one's really nice because it's the perspective of somebody, right, who's in the system and trying to do this work and bring dignity to the dead through a bureaucratic kind of perspective. So I think that's a really complimentary book to this. You know, you mentioned Roxana's book, We Were Once a Family. And, you know, I think it's just a beautifully written book. It was one that I had to read. I just shut out the rest of the world and I had to finish it basically in one sitting. Yeah. But what I think there is also sort of resonates with our book is this notion of family and kin and how, you know, what her story tells is, you know, this really broken foster care system in the United States and how families are sundered by the government. And, you know, so I felt like that was a book as I was writing The Unclaimed and reading hers, I thought this is another kind of perspective on what happens when government gets involved in family. So those are two that immediately come to mind for me.
I would like to add Caitlin Doughty's books. She has this book called Smoke, Get in Your Eyes. She's one of the proponents of the positive death movement. And what she's really good at pulling off is that she can be really funny, like hysterically funny about death and dying, but not irreverent. So she really finds that balance. And she's like a role model in how she spreads the word about dying well, thinking about your demystifying it, thinking about green funerals. So I very strongly recommend her.
I love that. I just have two questions. One is just about both of your sort of mental emotional states as you were working on such a complex book that has so many deep topics and is, you know, haunting in some ways. How were you each kind of preserving or tapping into your own creativity? Like, how were you able to not only take in all this information, but then still turn around and like turn out a book, like to write out of it?
Well, I think the challenge of this book was actually, so you would expect it to be the subject matter, that it's like heavy. It's people who are being abandoned by their family and by the community. But it was actually more finding hope in the stories. And that's what we do at the end of the book, when we talk about the ceremonies where strangers come together to bury strangers. And you the emotional ups, the highs that are part of these ceremonies, you carry them with you. You that balance out some of the abandonment and the sadness. But in generally, what I do is I go to the beach and I walk on the sand or on the boardwalk with my dogs, and that just really calms me down and puts everything back in perspective. And I think Pamela has similar kind of rituals that she uses.
No, that's true. Lots of walks along the canals of Amsterdam, which is a different view, especially in winter. But I think, okay, so in that sense, I think just at times just shutting off and focusing on the moment and being with my daughter, for example, and really just sort of savoring and cultivating a strong relationship with her has been really the saving grace for me throughout this process. And, you know, she's been there all along the way, and has kind of grown up with this book in the background and sometimes in the foreground for her life. And she is the fiercest cheerleader of this book and of me. And so just like, you know, wanting to make her proud, I think, is one thing that has definitely motivated me and kept me going throughout this process.
I love that. I do have to say, before I ask the last question, there are two gentlemen in the book who work for the county who do the cremations. Mm-hmm. And I am so glad that you all included them in the book, because I think that they were such like unsung heroes of this story. Mm-hmm. And I wish that we had more time, because I would have loved to talk about them more. But I thought they were so special to me in the reading process of this book, because they keep sort of coming up throughout the book. We kind of start with them and we keep going through. And I just really loved them. So thanks to them for their work, but also thanks to you all for highlighting them. And here's my last question. If you could have one person, dead or alive, read this book, who would you want it to be?
Okay, selfishly, Oprah.
Okay, I love that. Oprah and Obama are the only two correct answers, but other people give like different answers. And I'm like, well, that's nice, but it's Oprah and Obama.
I just be real honest. I want Oprah to read this and love it, okay? Put it on the book club.
I was actually thinking about Obama, and a second choice would be our current Surgeon General, who is very concerned about social isolation, so Vivek Murthy. But Obama would be, you know, a treat if he were to be able to read this book.
Well, you both passed the test. That's a real test right there. That's how you guys, I know you have PhDs, because you use your noggins, okay? Everybody at home, you can get The Unclaimed. It is now out in the world. I loved it so much. If you like what we around here call sort of micro histories or deep dives into really specific topics, this is for sure your book. Stefan and Pamela, thank you both so much for being here.
It was a tremendous pleasure.
And everyone else, we will see you in the stacks. All right, y'all, that does it for us today. Thank you so much for listening. And thank you again to Pamela Prickett and Stefan Timmermans for being my guests. I'd also like to say a huge thank you to Mary Motes and Lindsay Cook for helping to make this interview possible. Remember, next week is our March Book Club episode. Elise Hugh will be back to discuss Interior Chinatown by Charles Yu with us on Wednesday, March 27th. If you love the show and you want inside access to it, head to patreon.com/thestacks and join the Stacks Pack. If you want to read what I'm writing, check out my Substack called Unstacked at tracythomas.substack.com. Make sure you're subscribed to the Stacks wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, leave us a rating and a review. For more from The Stacks, follow us on social media at The Stacks Pod on Instagram, Threads, and TikTok, and at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter. And you can check out my website, thestackspodcast.com. This episode of The Stacks was edited by Christian Duenas with production assistance from Lauren Tyree. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and the theme music is from Tagirgis. The Stacks is created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.